from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about the discovery of what scientists believe are sinkholes in Lake Michigan.
A very small portion of the Great Lakes have been explored, and we really haven't mapped a lot of the bottom, and we also haven't gone and looked at the things that we see when we map.
Then we'll tell you about a historic statue of Milwaukee civil rights leader, Vell Phillips.
We had not one contrary voice to the idea of putting a sculpture of my mom up on the state capitol. I had buy-in across the aisle, and it's because she stepped across the aisle.
Plus, we'll tell you about some Milwaukee restaurant closures and what's new in dining in the city. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. In August, scientists with NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory discovered signs of underwater sinkholes in Lake Michigan. They found around 40 large sinkholes in Wisconsin's National Marine Sanctuary. They're cold, dark, and weirdly circular. The features are similar to sinkholes previously discovered in Lake Huron. But experts need more information before they can confirm that what's in Lake Michigan is just like the sinkholes in Lake Huron. Steve Ruberg joins WUWM's Lena Tran to share more. Ruberg is a physical scientist at the lab and begins by describing the sinkhole's accidental discovery.
Well, it's very similar to what happened in Lake Huron. There was an acoustic imaging survey. You know, they were looking for historic wrecks. So the National Marine Sanctuary, the Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary, did a survey. And during that survey, they came up with some bottom features that we wanted to go investigate. And we did. And a very similar thing happened here. The sanctuary, the new Wisconsin National Marine Sanctuary, they surveyed large bottom areas, and these features came up. And so we wanted to do the same thing. We wanted to go and have a look at them.
What are we even talking about here? What is a sinkhole?
We've been looking at sinkholes on Lake Huron, and the sinkholes in that situation are eroded limestone features. And so when you look at the geology of the Great Lakes, Lake Michigan and Lake Huron especially, other lakes as well, but sit on a limestone geologic layer that was laid down, you know, 400 to 500 million years ago. And then on top of that, you have glacial activity. So the ones in Lake Huron, we've verified that those are referred to as karst features, limestone geology that is eroded, a cavern forms, that cavern collapses and forms a sinkhole. It appears that's what's happening on Lake Michigan for the sinkholes that we've recently located on the west side of Lake Michigan. These appear to be limestone features, but you know, we haven't been able to verify that to a high degree of certainty. We feel like they probably are, but there are other options for what they could be as well. And the interesting thing about the Great Lakes in general is that, you know, a very small portion of the Great Lakes have been explored, and we really haven't mapped a lot of the bottom, and we also haven't gone and looked at the things that we see when we map the bottom. And what we want to do in this case is not just to go look. We're really trying to understand the amount of groundwater that might be coming into these systems. And along with groundwater, we want to know what the chemical makeup is.
Mm-hmm. At first, there was this hint that they might be there through the acoustic surveys. You know, what did that look like?
Yeah, so we took a remotely operated vehicle with some sensors on it that would allow us to detect groundwater. The ones that we looked at, we were measuring things. It's called specific conductivity, and of course, we're measuring temperature. When we get into the sort of the zone where there's groundwater in the ones in Lake Huron, we're seeing higher than normal water temperatures. That's an indication of groundwater. But we're seeing much higher than normal levels of specific conductivity, which indicates that since we're going through water going through this limestone systems picks up a lot of salt and sulfur and other minerals. And so that's an indication that we're seeing groundwater coming into these systems. And then what we wanted to do is then quantify the amount of groundwater that's sort of residing in a sinkhole. Now, unfortunately, the ones that we looked at in Wisconsin and on Lake Michigan, we did not detect a groundwater signature.
So what does that mean? Jury's still out?
Jury's still out. Yeah, that's exactly what it means. We did see a lot of interesting life down there. There, you know, we saw a number of deep water sculpin and, of course, unfortunately, a lot of quagga mussels and creatures like that. I'm not ready to say that this is a sinkhole that's similar to Lake Huron. These are much bigger, and they're just very strangely circular. It's really, they're very interesting. And so it's possible that if we get out deeper, just the natural erosion of the limestone, the groundwater will eventually stop coming into them. It's possible that the deeper ones may still have groundwater. And so then we'd be venturing outside of the sanctuary area that had already been mapped. You know, in the long run, we want to know how much water is coming in from these features. And that sort of adds to, we have a model of a lake level model. We know that the groundwater input into that lake level model is very, very small. But still, for completion, we'd like to try to get an idea of how much groundwater is coming in. The other thing, too, is that the groundwater has a lot of salt and sulfur. And knowing how much salt and sulfur chloride is getting into the system is important to sort of get a baseline for what the inputs of those sorts of things into the Great Lakes are.
What kinds of things might we learn from these features? What could it tell us about Lake Michigan or the geological history of the Great Lakes?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're hoping is that, you know, if there are these limestone karst features, you're going back, you know, 400 to 500 million years ago, right? And that's what the shallow sea that, you know, we sit on now is providing this signal of, you know, the chloride and the sulfate that I mentioned before. But then more recent times, you know, we've had, of course, glacial activity that formed the Great Lakes. And, you know, that could have laid down some of the clay features that we're seeing and that kind of thing. So it's just kind of telling us how the history of these systems and how they've changed over time.
Sinkholes represent unique refugia environments in the biosphere. Presumably, life like this was everywhere in the early biosphere. Now they are constrained to small pockets where there's no oxygen and high sulfur conditions.
That's Bopi Badanda. He's a microbial ecologist at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. And he's studied the microbes that live in Lake Huron sinkholes.
So there's the excitement of working with these extreme life forms that, you know, their way of life provides a window into the distant paleo past. I'm talking 2 to 3 billion years ago. In Lake Huron, there are shallow and deep water sinkholes. Shallow ones where sunlight comes in, and deep water where there no sunlight comes in. Here, low oxygen, high sulfur conditions fuel microbial mass, like ancient cyanobacteria that first oxygenated the planet. They colonize these lake bottoms and grow on it. Offshore, where there's no light, you can't have photosynthesis, so there's no cyanobacteria. They're chemosynthetic sulfur oxidizing bacteria. In the deep, there is only chemosynthetic white mats. And these are not very different from what the Alvin submersible and other deep sea submersibles see around deep sea vents, just white sulfur oxidizing microbial mats. So we have many analogs. Now, one life where probably life in the modern day lakes, which probably resembled, you know, the Proterozoic ocean, early seas, 3.3 billion years ago, and also analogs for deep sea sulfur vents. So right in our backyard, we have a window to the past as well as to the deep sea. One of the biggest question is how microbial mats like this in conditions similar to modern day sinkholes may have helped oxygenate our planet. So that is a big question. And there are clues to suggest these mats similar to these might have played a major role, because for the longest time, The shallow seas were all where a thin film of life clung to the sediments. And these could have gradually and slowly oxygenated the water column so life could become planktonic. And then when the seas and the atmosphere was well oxygenated, a couple of billion years later, life could crawl on to the terrestrial biosphere. So there's some of these deep roots we can examine, because all models and fossil evidence predicts and demonstrates might have existed 3 billion years ago are still almost the very same ones that we find in the sinkholes. So that's the big grand question. But it's very interesting to me that these small things, you know, hard to find and very little in stature, but they might have had an impact on our very, very being here today, you know, in evolutionary terms. And that they might, threatened as they might be, they might even survive us in the long run.
Bopi Badanda is a microbial ecologist at Grand Valley State University. You also heard from Steve Ruberg with NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. They both spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran. Coming up next, we'll speak with family and friends of civil rights activist Vel Phillips about a new statue erected in her memory in Madison. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This week, WUWM Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly is exploring who is and isn't honored in public art, like monuments and murals. Her series is called Reflections of Representation. This summer, a statue of Milwaukee politician and civil rights leader Vel Phillips was unveiled in Madison. It's the first sculpture of a Black woman on Capitol grounds in the country. Nadia spoke with a lifelong friend of Phillips and her son, Michael Phillips. They spoke in the plaza ahead of the statue's unveiling.
Now that, you know, the plaza is open, What are just some general feelings you have about seeing this space opened up to the public?
I have to say that of all of the sort of memorializing projects that I've been involved in the last 3 or 4 years, this one is closest to my heart. We're putting up a sculpture of my mom at the state capitol next month. We will have worked on that for 4 years, and it will be the first sculpture of an African-American woman on state capitol grounds nationwide. Mm-hmm. There is a book that's being published by the Wisconsin Historical Society I've been involved in and I've written for and for years. That's been in the works, but I have to say that this project is my closest to my heart. I have drafted all of the text for the kiosks and filled them with all of the pictures of my mom and my family. Mm-hmm. That feels like I am sharing them with the city of Milwaukee and by extension the entire world. It's been a long project, and the people who have helped me have been so diligent, so committed, and so expert that it is actually happening. I know nothing, and I knew nothing until I met these people, and together we have actually brought that to fore. Something that is probably goes unknown is that over the, 175 years of Milwaukee's history since 1948, the city of Milwaukee has spent less than an aggregate of under $500,000 on public art altogether. We are spending $600,000 for a signature art piece for this plaza alone. To me, that indicates the level of commitment that the city of Milwaukee, led by Mayor Johnson, is willing to invest here. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it is such a big undertaking. And there's so many ways that Bell Phillips is being recognized. Like you said, there's a sculpture, there's this plaza. Her legacy is becoming like permanently embedded into the city in like so many different forms. So I'm wondering, like you mentioned, like there's going to be like an artwork here installed. How are you hoping it, just how it like speaks to Bell's legacy?
That's really interesting because we started out with about 70 applicants from around the world. We narrowed it down to 10 and then to 3. And we're going to pay these individuals to come up with a proposal, an art proposal. And once they do, we'll select one. But I can't really say what that signature art piece is going to look like because they haven't created it yet. What I do understand is what I need for it to look like and what I need for it to celebrate is the diversity, the inclusion, the stepping across aisles to speak to individuals about the issues, fine, but who are they? That if there's one thing my mother had, it was antenna. It was about connecting with people, where they lived, that brought her such, I'd have to say, success in the world. She walked across the aisle like no one I've ever seen. When we were planning the sculpture for Madison, there's a statute, there's a law in Wisconsin that says no new statues on the state capitol grounds. There's a law. We had to get a variance, essentially. We needed an exception to allow them to allow us to build the statue, and we needed bipartisan support. And I worked in Madison. I've never seen an episode of bipartisan sort of work, ever. Republicans and Democrats couldn't agree that the sky was blue. We had not one contrary voice to the idea of putting a sculpture of my mom up on the state capitol grounds. I had buy-in across the aisle, and it's because she stepped across the aisle.
I think my last question has to do with, I think from the people that I've heard today speak, it seemed like Bell was really like for people. And to sort of hear that story where like people are now returning that, you know, overwhelming support that she poured back, what are you hoping for, I guess, the city of Milwaukee, like moving forward after these projects are realized?
I'm hoping that people will take a moment to understand the history that my mom sort of was involved in back in the civil rights movement and going forward. If there's one thing that I know that she taught me is that we have to understand who we were in order to understand who we are and where we are going. I know that there's been, from my mom's perspective and those who support her, some recent setbacks on the national stage. But if she were here, she would say, as long as we stick together, as long as you show up, showing up is half of the battle. Stay committed, stay focused, and stay together. We will come out. It's darkest before the dawn.
Thank you so much for your time. Again, I really appreciate it. Do you mind introducing yourself to me?
Sure. My name is Tiffany Kaler.
Can you explain like your relationship to Bell Phillips?
My relationship with Bell Phillips. Well, first of all, how long do you have? Because our relationship was really something. We were very, very close. She was a part of my family. I was a part of her family. We did everything together, and I really miss her dearly. You know, she had two boys, and she always said if she had a daughter, I would have been a daughter. And, you know, when my mother passed away back in 2010, Fel was right there on the couch with me at the funeral home. And, you know, she just was a great support. I loved her so much. I love Mike. And, you know, I miss her. And I think this is a beautiful plaza to remember her. I really hope that Milwaukee sees the depth of her sacrifices for the city and for the state and our country, because things were not easy for Val back when she was doing what she does. You know, she was always working on behalf of everybody. especially people that were oppressed, like unfortunately the African American community here in Milwaukee, and there's so much more work that we can be doing. But Val, I think this is a first step to keep her memory forefront and to, you know, carry on her legacy the best way that we can.
Thank you for that. I really appreciate that. Are there things that, like, you see today or things that resemble, like, her spirit or personality?
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing I noticed by coming down here is the diversity of the community and the people that always rallied around Val. Val was a person that could work with, which we sorely miss today, in such a polarized community. But I saw the diversity of the people that came out to celebrate her and to, you know, be part of this ribbon cutting. I mean, Val could reach across the aisle, and she had to work in the midst of adversity, and every day she would get back up and get going again. And, you know, I just think that people that come out to celebrate her are, you know, pioneers in their own right too, because it's not easy to be in a world today where people want to take a side. Val was very keen on what she needed to do to get to where we all needed to be, you know. So I just look around and I see a reflection of her friends, her family, her community.
You were talking about Val, like, facing adversity, and I mean, she really fought to fight for people. As someone, like, who knew her, where do you think that resilience comes from?
Well, I think the resilience that Val Phillips had really came from her faith. You know, one of her favorite scriptures was to be still. You know, it's a passage in the Old Testament about being still and know that God is God. And I know that she was a person of deep faith, a person who connected to a source higher than herself. And I think she got a lot of her energy, a lot of her perseverance from you know, something out of this world. And she would always say, just be still. Even though she was a busybody, it was kind of, I think, for her, that centering memory of being still, of listening for her direction, listening to getting through all the noise of society, and just listening.
I also wanted to ask you about the sculpture. I mean, there's just a lack, just a general lack of, like, statues of Black people in this country, and it's going to be such an impactful piece of public art. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, when Val was alive, you know, I saw her as just Val. She was just Val. She was a person that could, you know, kind of put me in my place when I needed to be put in my place. Val was a mentor, my friend. Oftentimes she was very like a mother, looking out for my best interests. And, you know, she's going to make history again, even though she's not with us here physically. But she'll be the first African-American woman to ever have a statue at a state house in our country. So she's making history still, which is kind of cool.
Tiffany Kaler is a longtime friend of Val Phillips, and Michael Phillips is Val Phillips' son. They spoke with WUWM Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly for her series, Reflections of Representation. You can find more of that series at WUWM.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about some new restaurants in Milwaukee and some old favorites that have recently closed. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As the summer is nearing its end, many of us are trying to soak in the good weather while we can. And what better way than by checking out a new local restaurant? As the dining editor for On Milwaukee, Lori Frederick always has her eye on what's happening in Milwaukee's food scene. She joins me now to talk about some exciting new restaurants that have opened over the past few months and some beloved eateries that are now closed. Lori, thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Thanks, Joy.
So one of the things that I think we've seen emerge, certainly over the last 10 years, but specifically over the last year, is this really large kind of restaurant row, let's call it, in Bayview. And that has really exploded over the last year with a few big openings, one of which I think a lot of people were excited about, Esther Ev. It had been inside of another restaurant. Now it's in its own location. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. And this is so interesting because it's the northern end of Bayview, which traditionally just hasn't been a destination before. You know, you have Barnacle Buds kind of adjacent to that. It's now a hotbed for all sorts of things. Esther Ev is one of them. This was the restaurant inside of a restaurant that was built into Dan Dan. It was basically a little room, and Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, you could go in and have a very affordable tasting menu from chefs Dan Jacobs and Dan Van Wright, both of whom who had come from kind of a more moderate to fine dining background. And I think it was their creative space. You know, when they weren't creating Asian American cuisine at Dan Dan, you know, this was their space to do things, you know, in a different way. And there was talk for many years about giving Esther Ev its own space. And that happened this past year. Interestingly, it sort of intersected with Top Chef. May have been somewhat intentional, maybe not. But the Esther Ev location, so this moved into the former Ceviche restaurant in Bayview. And this horde of other restaurants sort of followed around it. So there is Room Service and Todd, I Believe I Can Fry, which are part of a property that's an investment on the part of the owners of Rice and Roll Bistro on the east side. And their desire was to create kind of a community of little Asian restaurants that brought something to Milwaukee that we did not have. So Room Service is a high-end Thai restaurant that has really, really made a splash. It's impressive and modern and very traditional Thai at the same time. And Todd, I Believe I Can Fry is like just a destination for indulgent fried Asian-inspired things, from wings, you know, to all the things. But anything you want that's fried can be fried and sauced, you can find at Todd, I Believe I Can Fry. And then right across the street from that, we also got a second location for Paloma Tacos and Tequila, which was a pretty popular concept in East Wauwatosa that then put a second location in Bayview. And between those four new restaurants, with a couple more to come, including a Burmese spot and a new bar, that area right there within a block is just a hotbed of, you know, various types of food.
The next place we're going to talk about, actually, I don't know if there's anything quite like it. The closest thing I could think of is not at all similar. So let's just talk about this. It's called Diverse Dining Market.
Yes. And this is the evolution of what was Turning Tables. And Turning Tables was a Emerald Mills had started a diverse dining initiative a number of years ago, where she wanted to bring people together, diverse groups of people, to have conversations. And the theory being that there aren't enough spaces in the city where people come together who are from different backgrounds. And so let's intentionally bring people together over a meal and have discussions. We can make friends, have long-term relationships that are created and, you know, potentially solve some of the cities or the world's problems at the same time. That turned into a concept kind of as Emerald went along with the knowledge that we also just need more representation from Black and brown businesses, and that there were a lot of entrepreneurs who just didn't have what they needed to pull forward, you know, to make their businesses work. So Turning Tables was the first effort at creating training programs for BIPOC businesses, small food businesses. And it has evolved into being, I think, what's a very, very clear concept. So this is a little marketplace that kind of, it runs like a little fast casual counter. There are folks that work there that are trying to get experience in the dining industry. There are also, I think right now, two or three food entrepreneurs who have concepts. One of them is a woman who makes apparently a few different kinds of delicious lasagna. And she serves a couple of days a week, you know, during lunch. One of them is Mr. Barbecue, who has kind of been with the concept for a while, but I think he serves on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And there are a couple of other entrepreneurs, and they're actually calling upon food entrepreneurs to join them with the idea that they will increase the hours in the space, maybe offer dinner, but lunches and dinners, all from these different folks. And it gives the entrepreneurs the practice of kind of running their own business in a really safe space, getting exposure for their concepts so that they can go on and do bigger and better things. And in the meantime, the whole concept is attached still to this idea of bringing people together from diverse backgrounds to talk about different things. So they will have events related to that, corporate training, things like that, that they offer. But for now, it's a great place right downtown in the 250 building. And it's a great place for breakfast. They open pretty early, 7 or 8 in the morning. It's a good place to grab breakfast or coffee. You can also grab lunch there. So it's added to downtown while also serving a pretty cool purpose.
Now we'll get to the closings in just a moment, which unfortunately do include a couple of supper clubs, beloved supper clubs. It does feel like often in Wisconsin we're talking about, you know, the loss of what a lot of us view as our heritage. There is a new supper club, though, that is coming to the Milwaukee area.
There is. It's called Relish Supper Club. It is from the Angels Share Hospitality Group, which also owns the Stillery. So they have a location in Richfield and in Grafton. Some people might be familiar. Relish went into what was for a very long time Jerry's Old Town in Germantown. And now it's being repurposed as a supper club. It is very much classic supper club in a lot of ways, maybe a little bit more polished. You know, there's hardwood floors instead of, you know, the old school carpeting. There are things like the relish tray is there in spades because it's a relish buffet. So the free relish trays that most supper clubs have, you know, they're hit or miss. People either eat them or there are things, you know, there's a table that's big fans of the radishes and other tables that will leave the radishes there. Well, at Relish, for $5, you can go up and have access to everything from the deviled eggs to the cheese and charcuterie and vegetables and all of the pickles and different things. Pick what you want and what you actually will eat. So that's a little bit of a modern twist, also in keeping with the name. And the other thing they have that is going to be very popular, and I think already is ice cream drink flights. So they have 4 ice cream drinks on the menu: Brandy Alexander, Grasshopper, Pink Squirrel, and the Golden Cadillac. You can have one, you know, decide on one, or you can have a flight of all 4. You know, so I think they're $10 a cocktail or $20 for the flight. And I think the idea of going with friends and maybe everybody doesn't want a whole ice cream drink but might want to sample littler ones, it's catching on pretty well.
Very nice. Yeah. Now, moving on to closings. We're going to start with a couple of beloved supper clubs in the area. Dobie's Steakhouse was around for more than 70 years, I believe.
Yeah. And this was a sad one. It was a family-operated restaurant for most of that 70 years. And I think about 2 or 3 years ago, Chef Michael Fecker, who owns a variety of restaurants in the area, the family was selling the restaurant. It was going to close. He did take it over. I think that the transition was just really tough, as it tends to be. There were changes made, and, you know, we don't like change in the case of especially beloved things like supper clubs. We want things to stay the same forever. And so this has just been a few months in the past, and Dobie's is gone, at least for the time being. We'll see. Sometimes those places get picked up by someone who really wants to preserve a concept or the history of a space.
We've also said goodbye to Eric's Porterhouse. Now, it wasn't around quite as long, but also a long-standing restaurant.
Yeah. No, Eric's Porterhouse was started in 1997 by Eric, the namesake, Holm. and named for the porterhouse steak. The king of all steaks is what they call it there. Part of the popularity, I think, or at least the recognition of Eric's Porterhouse is that it's in this very impressive Greek Revival style building on Wisconsin Avenue in Waukesha. It's a historical property. It's on the register and was the longtime home to one of Waukesha's mayors and someone else significant along the way who actually, I think, built the home. But, it, you know, I mean, the Greek Revival style, it sort of sticks out, you know, because we don't have much that is of that. but aside from that, I mean, very beloved, especially in Waukesha, for those who have gone there. In this particular case, Eric Holm made the decision to retire. So guests can celebrate with him and he can enjoy, you know, the remainder of his life without the stress of the restaurant industry, which is significant.
Now, there are a couple of closures here that really surprised me as someone who had gone to these places, and they always seemed relatively busy mm-hmm. and popular. We'll start with Company Brewing in River West.
Yeah. Company Brewing was a loss, not because a little microbrew pub restaurant in River West, but because it was really kind of a change maker at the time. We did have a few brew pubs, but we had nothing really here. While kind of these gastro pubs that escalated the food, you know, and the beer to another level were kind of popping up across the U.S., Wisconsin had remarkably few of them. And so in a time when, you know, we had Milwaukee Ale House and a couple of other places, but just not many restaurants with little microbreweries in them. So they broke some ground when they opened. They also kept up some neighborhood traditions. You know, they were continued to be a music venue, which is what the former tenants had done. That has always been a place to go watch music. And it became a really popular gathering place for the neighborhood. And River West doesn't let things close lightly. So this was kind of a surprise. And not everything is disclosed when restaurants do close. What I can say is there have been a number of closings this year that have, understanding the circumstances, I'm not sure I'm surprised. But the circumstances are such where these places wouldn't have to close if we weren't in such a bizarre market right now. You know, we've made it out of the pandemic, which technically is like, okay, restaurants should be doing great now, right? But some of them that have been around for a while are carrying debt, which kind of has pushed them behind. We've had quite a bit of inflation, especially with regard to food. And for restaurants, like the cost for restaurants that we're kind of seeing reflected in the grocery store, I read something the other day that it's like 3 or 4 times worse for restaurants. We also came out of a pandemic, and the demand for wages to be higher really has put a stress, you know, to keep and retain employees. Folks have had to raise wages, and this has raised menu prices, and the raised menu prices, with the economy being what it is and with people feeling often a little bit tight in the pocketbook, has changed the way people dine. Company Brewing sort of falls in that category where something that was doing pretty well prior to the pandemic, you know, has just been way more challenged following the pandemic.
I wondered that with the next restaurant we'll talk about, Fans Garden. Now, they were around for, I believe, more than 30 years in that space. And the building looks like it's being used in some ways, but I'm not sure how.
It looks like there's maybe a Lao restaurant going into the space. It is owned by the temple that's adjacent to it, the building. So it being an Asian restaurant will likely continue on. I've not actually heard the reasoning. Fans Garden closed pretty silently. There wasn't much talk about whether someone retired, you know, maybe there was family members who didn't want to take on the restaurant any longer. But because I've been here for over 3 decades, it's quite possible that the owners were just done. But, you know, this was for a very long time Milwaukee's only real representation of Vietnamese food. So it's a loss in that way. It's a nostalgic place. Probably the first place a lot of people in the city ever ate pho. So it will be missed.
Another Southside restaurant that closed recently, Damascus Gate.
Yeah. Damascus Gate also kind of silently just fell off the map. And I came upon it because I came upon a note on the door that said, we are closed and there's something new coming. And as I stopped back, I reached out to a number of people who had been affiliated with the restaurant, and folks didn't really get back to me. The sad thing about Damascus Gate is that it was both an amazing place to eat. Not only was it one of the only places where you could find Syrian food in the city and delicious food at that, but it was a haven and a place for refugees who'd come from that area to make a living, essentially. And the restaurant was essentially founded by a doctor. Dr. Nassef, I believe, ran a sleep clinic, but he was also very active in the refugee community with taking people in, getting people from their countries to the U.S., and then providing them with resources to get them on their feet, up and running here, whether it was English classes or, you know, means of income, places to stay, you know, apartments and such. This was kind of a side project of his. He bought the restaurant space and remodeled it and gave it a kitchen and then basically gave it to a cadre of Syrian refugees and said, you know, you can run this business and make money. Dr. Nassef passed away in 2021. And I think while the restaurant obviously continued for a few more years, I think it's part of their foundation. You know, I think things became a little less stable without him in the background. I know his loss was palpable. I mean, he was just a really gracious, amazing fellow. And it's hard to watch things like this. One of the hardest closures I think I had to report this year. But we'll see. We'll see. I've heard undercurrents that something similar might be bubbling up, but I haven't really heard what that might be yet.
We'll see what the future holds. Lori, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of your work.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Lori Frederick is the dining editor for On Milwaukee. At WUWM.com, you can find our previous conversations about dining in Milwaukee. Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet are among the most beloved brands from Wisconsin, and with good reason. Where else can you buy an enormous bag of circus peanuts, a new pair of jeans, and a baby chick, all at the same time? But there's a persistent myth plaguing the legacy of these two stores, one that frames them as dueling brands forever locked in a battle for dominance. So we're here to set the record straight with Archer Parkett, managing editor of Milwaukee Magazine. Archer, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Starting into this story, it reminded me a lot of a story I did a while back on the origins of the word bubbler. Similarly, there's this persistent myth in the case of the bubbler that Kohler invented the term when someone there designed a drinking fountain. But the whole thing is bunk. There are no records of this supposed designer, and Kohler wasn't even doing plumbing at the time. Yet you'll still hear people repeating this claim and really sticking to it. What I found fascinating about Farm and Fleet, or Fleet Farm, they have a very similar legend with that same kind of allegiance. Can you explain a bit about that?
Yes, definitely. I think that's a great example of the bubbler story. What really makes the legend interesting is how devoted people are to it. So there are different versions of the legend, but the most common that I've heard is that Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet originated with two different brothers, or at least distant relatives, and that they had both started it together, started it for a few years, and then had some sort of big feud that maybe it was over a girl they both liked, or they had different ideas about the business. And they got in such a big fight that they split it up. There was some legal action involved, and they had to branch out into different parts of Wisconsin and change their name. So that's why we have such similar names, Fleet Farm and Farm and Fleet. The other version of the legend that's most common is that it was a couple who started it, and that the couple divorced, and that they had to split the store in the divorce settlement and had that same name change thing in the end. That myth has been persistent in Wisconsin for the 6 or 7 decades that those stores have been around.
It seems like regardless of the relationship at the center of it, there is this idea that there was this big rupture that caused the branching off of these competing farm and fleets and or fleet farms. The actual story has a lot more to do with tax law than I'd anticipated, but it does include brothers, two sets of them, in fact. How do we come to have this dueling, as it were, farm and fleet farm?
Yeah, the actual story, strangely enough, the two franchises are quite parallel. Both franchises started in 1955. Two sets of brothers, Bert and Claude Blaine and Stu and Hank Mills. The Blaine brothers, they were in their middle age at the time. They owned car dealerships throughout Wisconsin. And the Mills brothers were much younger. I believe they were in their 20s. They were the sons of Stuart Mills, who had his own auto company as well, selling cars. So what happened in the 50s were there were these very stringent minimum markup laws in Wisconsin. We still have some of those laws, but they're not nearly as strict as they were back then. So back then, retailers could not sell things at much of a discount at all. It was considered unfair. They all had to mark things at the same price. One of the only exceptions was for customers who owned a fleet, which meant that they had 5 or more internal combustion engines. So the way that was defined, it could be cars, tractors, even a couple of lawnmowers counted. So at the time, the people who had that many engines in Wisconsin were farmers. And so both the Mills and the Blaine brothers realized that they could get around these markup laws by focusing on the people who had fleet cards, farmers. So what they both did was they started their own stores. The Mills brothers started in Marshfield and the Blaine brothers started in Janesville. Their goal was to sell farm supplies to people with fleet cards. So they were offering these goods at just prices way better than normal store could offer. And it really was sort of a genius idea at the time. And that's where part of the dueling aspect comes into play, is the idea of who came up with it first. Was it the Mills brothers or the Blaine brothers? And once I started to look into it, that conflict goes even further. They both joined the Mid-States Co-op, which was a group of multiple stores with the same business model, ran by a couple called Bob and Jean Kiesow. And to this day, the Mid-States Co-op claims they came up with the idea. So the Mills brothers, the Blaine brothers, and the co-op all sort of at this point lay claim to having come up with the idea originally. But yeah, in 1955, they both started their first store selling to folks with fleet cards.
It's interesting that there are these two sets of brothers who have started stores. There isn't that kind of rupture at the center. And what I found even more interesting is they weren't the only fighting fleet farmers, as it were. There were a variety of them in the state. Do you have any idea how many there were?
There were dozens pushing 70 to 80 around the Midwest in that late 50s, early 60s time. Because it was just such a great idea, because there was no other way to market these discount goods at the time. But yeah, I looked up some of the old documents about some of these places. There was Farm and Fleet Field Service, Quality Farm and Fleet Supply, Dinsmore Farm and Fleet, Steve's Farm and Fleet. They were all over. It was not just the two that have grown into the sort of Wisconsin behemoths.
Well, and that really gets to what they are now. They are these kinds of behemoths. They may have had these, you know, I don't know if you would even call them humble origins, because both of these sets of brothers came from relatively well-off families, but they are in many ways the last remaining fleet farm ventures, as it were. Perhaps even more oddly, even though they were competing, it seems like they had a friendly relationship.
Yes, actually. I spoke to some of the folks who still work at those stores. Unfortunately, both sets of brothers have passed on since then. But yeah, everyone reports friendly relations between the families. There's really no one who says that there was any rivalry outside of, you know, the basics of business. In fact, some of the folks who knew the brothers told me that like Bert and Stu Mills were actually pretty good friends. The personal aspect of the rivalry really does not have any basis in reality that I could tell.
Now here's, I think, the final question. Do you think Wisconsinites are ready for the real story of farm and fleet / fleet farm?
You know, I don't know, because the real story is just not quite as fun as the fake one. My favorite part of the story was talking to people from the stores and just hearing how often people would tell them their version of the legend and insist that it was real. Even people who knew the original brothers, who had been there for decades, would have customers who just would not listen and insist that it was this personal split. I think it's just a great story. It's very unique that we have these similarly named stores that are so well-loved and have such strong fan bases. And I think the fact that there's this legend adds a whole another layer to it, and the reality's a little bit less fun. But yeah, I think once people learn the real story, it actually is kind of interesting in its own way. The way it developed out of these legal loopholes and the way they've grown their business and become this real cultural Wisconsin touchstone, I think.
For sure. Well, Archer, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Great, thank you.
Archer Parkett is the managing editor of Milwaukee Magazine. This conversation is from 2022. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the restoration and rededication of a bronze monument that was nearly stolen from Forest Home Cemetery. Plus, we'll tell you about a podcast called My Cousin Augie, about a local journalist's search for answers about her cousin, who was killed in a car bombing in the late 1970s. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.